Hi, I'm Kaylee, a college student and pretend journalist who was conceived with donor sperm in 1999. This is Message in a Bottle. Hi, welcome or welcome back. For this episode, I was joined by Melissa, a different Melissa than from a few weeks ago. I knew it was a matter of time before interviewing two people with the same name, but yes, this is a different Melissa. And both of them are involved with separate organizations that are abbreviated as DCC, so that's not confusing at all. But anyway, this Melissa is the founder of the Donor Conceived Community, which just became a nonprofit, which is exciting. The DCC provides support and education and different resources for people navigating donor conception and surprising DNA discoveries. There are a number of different free peer-led support groups, like a Jewish discovery group and a BIPOC donor conceived group. I spoke to Eric a few weeks ago and he told me a lot about that, to name a few of these examples. But Melissa was actually the first person I really met back when I started to research donor conception online. So it was great to talk again and hear more about her story. I will briefly remind you to click follow on whatever platform you're listening on. Follow the show's Instagram at Message in a Bottle Podcast. And if you're feeling crazy, tap the little 5 stars. And sign up for a peer support group meeting if any of them apply to you and you're interested. I've been to one. It was really great. Everything is linked in the description, though. But okay, here's Melissa.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Hi, editing Kaylee here. We ended up talking about some DC-related stuff that wasn't exactly on topic. For like 30 minutes. But once we got back on track, I asked her to introduce herself.
So I'm Melissa, and I grew up in California. I was born in the 70s and to two parents, mom and a dad, and I have a twin sister and a younger sister. And it was a very uneventful to me just upbringing. I didn't think anything was different. I thought I was like most of the people around me. And my parents separated when I was a freshman in high school, and my dad died by suicide shortly after. Mm-hmm. And I was really close with my dad. And so most of my high school and college years were really spent trying to figure out how to hold on to that relationship with him. And I was really sentimental about that relationship. I also was grieving, but I didn't have a lot of language for that at the time. It was still the time when we didn't talk as much about what a grief process was. But I was really holding on to relationships with my dad's side of the family as much as I could, because I wanted that connection with him. And I eventually, after college, moved to the Midwest and got married and had 3 kids and was fully immersed in mom life. Throughout that time, I think probably because of my what had happened with my dad, I always was paying attention to mental health. Partially, I was really worried about my own mental health because I was concerned that mm-hmm. the things that my dad had struggled with would be genetic. And so
right, would it come up?
There were health struggles in the family too that I was looking out for and, you know, keeping an eye out for my grandmother's heart problems and some cancer in the family. But I was really careful about certain things, just almost with like a fear of, am I going to outrun this or not? Or is it going to sneak up and get me? And so mm-hmm. I was always, in a sense, looking over my shoulder for depression to sneak up on me. and I, it was it was 7 years ago now that there was a strange conversation with a family friend where they mentioned something about us finding our biological father, and we didn't know what he meant. But I had already been interested in, was planning on doing a DNA test to find out more about my dad's side of the family and his relatives. He had some interesting family stories. And so I wanted to learn more about some of that. And I had almost purchased a DNA kit so many times, but didn't because of price. And then this conversation happened and my sister and I talked and we were trying to figure out like what it could mean. And then we had a follow-up conversation with this family member or family friend, and they shared that my parents had used a sperm donor to conceive us. And at first I thought it was my younger sister because she's 7 years younger than me. So in my mind, I filled in the blank that my dad got a vasectomy after sister and I were born, and then they changed their mind. And then I was shocked all over again to find out that it was me and my twin sister too. But I'm from the fresh, not frozen era. And so they also use the swirl method. I started learning more about the industry at the time, and I learned that that was really likely. Also, I don't think my mom fully understood what was going on. So I don't think it was explained at that time. So I learned more about that and learned that they probably used the swirl method. My parents probably thought that it could be that right. My dad could be my biological father. So after we got the DNA test results, I found out that my younger sister was my half sister. And then my cousin on my dad's side, I shared with her what was going on, and she took a DNA test. And then I found out that my dad wasn't my biological father, and I was crushed. I think because for so long I had been holding on to that genetic connection, looking for him in my kids, and really thought I was going to keep whatever connection I could, not just in the stories, but anything, any attachment I had to my dad, I wanted to keep. And so it was a loss all over again and very confusing. But I think similar to most people who have this discovery later in life, I just was so confused. Who is my biological father, and how do I find this out? But I was scared to know.
Right.
Who is it going to be? And is it better not to find out? I wanted to somehow like look ahead and read the last pages or something and know who it was, and then decide if I wanted to finish the book.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
It's like, oh, this is too scary. And I had this feeling too, maybe I should just leave it alone, go with what I know. And I've always been a really curious person though. And so I tried out leaving it alone, and I couldn't leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And so I took 23andMe test, the 23andMe test first, and then I took Ancestry, and I found some distant cousins on Ancestry. And so I started digging and digging. I hit several dead ends and then had a crazy, I registered on Donor Sibling Registry. I didn't have very much information to go on, but I ended up getting a phone call out of the blue from somebody who had information to help me. They found me through Donor Sibling Registry, and they gave me some really helpful information that helped me find out, get me back on a better path to finding out who my biological father was. So I think I found out in 2016, maybe 2017, maybe the early part. And then, I was so scared to do anything about it. I finally wrote a letter in May of 2017, and then I didn't hear anything back. So I tried to let it go again, but I couldn't let it go. And I realized I just wanted to at least see him. Well, first I just wanted medical information. That's what I told myself. I just want medical information, which is really common. I think people say, this is all I want. And, but I didn't get even medical information. So then I realized, I think this might be like the life stage that I was at, where I had really started to wrestle with thinking more about what I wanted about in situations instead of just what would keep other people happy. And so I felt this pressure that socially it was more acceptable to just want medical information. Like I'd be asking for too much if I wanted more.
Mm-hmm.
People were very eager to give advice to me.
Oh yeah.
About what I should or shouldn't want, and to respect his privacy.
Yeah.
And here was his intention when he donated, and I needed to understand that. And I think people also were just didn't want to see me struggle. And so they would try to say helpful reminders, which I know is very common among donor conceived people. We talk about these things, people saying, but you're still the same person, and your parents loved you, and this doesn't change anything. But most donor conceived people that I've spoken with will also tell you how much time they've spent staring in the mirror and looking at, you know, features, or I stare at my hands when I was driving and just think, I don't know where anything comes from. And so I eventually realized I did want to see him or meet him just once. And I also realized I would be okay if he rejected me, that it would really hurt and it would be probably something it took me some time to get over. But even if he were to say, you don't exist to me, I was never supposed to know who you are, and never, and if he never wanted to speak to me again, that I would be okay. I had survived worse and it would be okay. Mm-hmm. So I did something I wouldn't recommend to anybody to do, but I flew to go hand deliver the letter that I wasn't sure if he had received.
Oh my God. That's crazy. But like props, like, yeah, I've thought of doing kind of like out there. No, I know what you mean.
And there was this time when it was somewhat impulsive. There were some other circumstances that lined up to make it a doable trip. And I had figured out how to do it in a way that wasn't, wouldn't be like traumatic for him or embarrassing for him. So I felt like I was respecting those things. I wasn't gonna, out him in any way to other people or anything like that. So that was good. But I had these, jokes that I made with myself or to other people. It's funny how that is one of the coping things, is to joke about it. So I came up with all these, you know, funny ways to things I would say. And I do think that's something funny now, how common that is, of those little jokes that we would make of, you know, do I look familiar or, you know. So, but we had a really meaningful first meeting that I still replay in my, I mean, it's a really big moment in my life, and I'm really thankful for the choice that I made and would do it again a million times
over. Did you just like knock on his door? No.
No, I knew where he worked, and in a sense, I didn't make an appointment, but it was the setup of his workplace was the kind where I could have a private conversation with him. And I meant to just give him the letter to make sure that he read it. So I was just going to say, here's a letter that I sent to you that I'm not sure if you read. So that was my plan, was just to make sure he got the letter. But then I would have been able to see who he was. And then if he wanted to contact me after, then he could read the letter and do that. I just wanted to make sure he got it. But it turned out once he saw me, he had already seen and read the letter and seen my picture. So once he saw me, he knew who I was, and he actually thanked me for contacting him. So he had just been, I think, well, he said he didn't know what to say and he hadn't known how to reply. And so in that delay, he hadn't said anything. So that's so interesting. I think it's common. I think people donated years ago and they thought it would be anonymous, and there aren't resources for people who donated to figure out what to do now. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have a guidebook either of what to say or do. So I think in that time he was probably very confused about what he should say. So he recognized me, and his specific words were, "Thank you for your perseverance," which was fitting and meant a lot to me because it helped me to know that I hadn't done something that felt like an invasion to his privacy or anything like that.
Right, right.
Now we have a friendship. He's a really special person, and I'm really glad that I know him. So, yeah.
That's a good ending. Wow. So your sister, I remember you saying this about how your twin sister has a very different like reaction to all of this, right? Like she's not interested.
Yeah, she's not. I couldn't speak to what her, I guess what her feelings are about it, because we don't talk about it, and she would prefer not to. And so it's her journey and mm-hmm. not the same as mine. And so she, to my knowledge, hasn't done a DNA test. We haven't showed up matching on 23andMe or Ancestry. And I don't know exactly all of her reasons for it, but I do know that I've noticed as I've talked to donor conceived people that it's really common for one sibling to want to know more and want to explore it, and another sibling to either not want to, or to be indifferent, or again, I don't know all the feelings that go with it. If it's, it could be somebody just very overwhelmed and doesn't know what to do. So I don't want to put words or thoughts or feelings. I don't want to assign them without knowing, but we have not walked the same path with it. My younger sister and I talk about it. So that's different. We do talk about it, but it's interesting to see how in the same family people can have different responses to it. I don't know. I've never talked to my half siblings that I share with my biological father. So I know that I think they all know about me. I know for sure that my biological father has told me that two of them do, and I don't know what their feelings are on it. So it's kind of strange.
Of them?
No, he only donated one time. So I have a unique situation that I know how many siblings I have. So he raised all of his other, all of his other children. So there's a fixed number, which is also unique.
Yeah, that is. And it is different because it's the fresh versus frozen.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, there's no concern about defrosting 10 years later and getting another batch of siblings. So,
But a lot of the fresh era people have these biological fathers who, like, they just go off, you know, and they have like these 80 sibling, like, you know, it's like, God, it's a lot of effort.
So, and we haven't talked much about the groups yet, I know, but just sharing, I get to see a wide variety of stories from the members in the groups. And it's interesting how many people built it into their budget or their routine. Like they know I did this twice a week for 2 years, or I did this, you know, three times. I mean, sometimes the frequency is really
like
shocking to me, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But there are some people.
Yeah, like passive income.
Yes. Yes. Or yeah, passive was a little asterisk next to it, right? Because so they planned it. It was a budget item. It's how they paid their rent or how they paid their groceries. And there were people who their partners were aware of it. And that was part of the monthly budget. So I think too, there's a different experience for people who did it altruistically. They were really thinking through, I'm helping someone who couldn't have a child if I didn't do this. And then there are people where it strictly was, this is an easy way to make some extra money.
Yeah. Just fair.
And it's so strange to see the dollar amount assigned to it. $30. It, you know, this person got paid $30 and that's how I exist. Or this person got paid $50. That's how I exist. And especially in sperm donation, because egg donation is a totally different pay scale.
I used to use that as like a justification. Like that used to make me feel better. Like I'd be like, well, at least I'm not one of these people who, you know, I'm not an accident. Like I was very intentional. Like this was a plan and I was paid for, you know. But then the more that I think about that, I'm like, oh, it feels sort of like commodified. Like it's a weird that it's like a transaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, back in the day, people would have copies of checks, or after the check was cashed, it would be sent back. And so there are people in the groups who their parents have the copy of the check that they made out to the clinic for the dollar amount. And they have expressed that it's very strange to hold that in their hand and say, this is how much it cost. And it's interesting too, because it really highlights, is it a product you bought? Then of course there's a receipt. So, you know, if I was thinking about my wedding and I paid for a wedding dress, and I would have the receipt for the wedding dress. But what I wouldn't want to see is a receipt for how much someone got paid to marry me. And so I think it's a strange space in the middle to say, here's how much someone paid for me to be conceived, for the actual gamete that it took to conceive me. So,
right. It's like they didn't pay for the kid. Like it's not like trafficking or something. It's like you pay for the material. Yeah, that is weird. I mean, I bet adoptees have sort of, it's kind of similar, but that actually is more like, we give you money, you give me the baby. Like, no.
Well, what I've learned, I don't know as much about the adoption world as I would like to, but it's similar from what I've learned as it can be in the fertility world, because you're not allowed to buy an embryo, just like you're not allowed to buy a baby, but there can be a whole lot of fees. In the process, where maybe you didn't buy the actual person, but there's a whole lot of money changing hands for the process to take place.
Right. It's like adoption is expensive, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of fees involved that make it very much feel like there was a purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if it's legal, then it's going to require legal fees. And But yeah.
But egg donation, technically, you're not like selling your eggs, right? They compensate you for your time. That's like, I think the language. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
But yeah, it's not hard to find the language of, you can get paid this much for up to this many cycles, but you can only do the next cycle if the previous cycle got if you qualified by getting enough eggs. And so
right.
if you
so it
meeting the threshold of the product, you wouldn't do another round. So it, yeah, it's very, I'd say it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
For sure. And it's either way, the feelings that people have for finding out that money changed hands, I think it is harder when all of that comes as a surprise, when people didn't know that they were donor conceived. But I wouldn't be shocked if, and your experience, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if somebody had a struggle with it, even if they've known for a long time, but I can see where in your story too, it might just change meaning over time, that at first it makes you feel better and then you're not sure what you think about it.
And then you're looking through the catalog and you're like, oh my God, you know?
Yes. Yes, for sure. The catalog feature, it's really interesting. I was talking to somebody who works at a clinic and they've talked about how the catalog, for the parents, the catalog helps them connect more to choosing a donor and it makes it feel less impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So on their side of it, they feel like it's helping make it more relational for the parent who's looking for a donor. So it's really interesting that on the other side of the experience as a donor conceived person, it does not feel more personal to see a catalog.
Yeah. You know? It was more of a spreadsheet. Like I was able to find the actual like documents and stuff with like Internet Archive. You know, I was able to find like my guy on the Excel spreadsheet where it was like, you know, a blood type and, you know, philosophy major, you know, that stuff was like listed.
Wow.
In the spreadsheet, but it wasn't like a catalog that you like flip through, like, you know, where you like circle the, you know, it's not like, and they didn't get any like baby pictures or any of the stuff that people do now, which that it's weird, honestly, to see it in a spreadsheet where you like see all these like numbers listed, like a factory weird, you know?
Yeah.
But like I get both
almost
sides
like
of it about why that would make you feel better to kind of get some more information about the person. But then at the same time, it makes you feel kind of weird when you're the kid. Like, yeah. What if they had just picked the one right above, you know?
Right. It makes it feel like just one of so many options. Have you seen some of the bank's websites where you can upload a picture of who you're trying to match and it will recognize the facial features or the facial structure and then pick out a donor that matches?
Oh my God.
I know.
That's like dystopian. That's
I know. I know. And it's promoted as, you know, they're one of their selling features. And I just don't know how, on one hand, I can see parents saying that they want to choose a donor that looks similar to their family. As soon as it gets to uploading pictures and data matching, that's where it feels so impersonal that I don't know how it's trying to replace something that was relational with something that's
like
data driven.
Yeah.
Algorithm. And that just feels
like sterile or something. Like,
yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. It definitely adds to the feeling of being made by an industry instead of. And it's interesting though, that it feels that way as a donor conceived person to see it that way. And yet apparently to a parent trying to conceive, it makes them feel more in control, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah. I can't even remember what we were talking about your sister. Well, so when you found out about all this, was your mom, like, what was her reaction?
That's really complicated. she had a variety of reactions. And it's complicated.
Yeah, we don't have to get into it.
I think what it highlighted for me is that a discovery of being donor conceived as an adult will always tangle with other things that were already challenges in a relationship. Mm-hmm. So it put tension in all the places that already had tension. So that's probably the best way to summarize it. And I think that that's probably why I am trying to be so intentional about helping parents understand that it's really important to talk about it with their kids when they're young, because it gets really complicated to talk about it later.
Yeah.
Because no parent-child relationship is perfect. So whatever places of tension there are, it's going to add to that if there's a surprising discovery like this. Mm-hmm. I would say, though, like after it's changed over time. So at first it was really, really hard. We had a lot of conflict over it. In my mom's case, I think she was going through her own shock and discovery in a sense.
Right, because she was surprised too.
Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time trying to figure out how surprised she should be and how surprised she really was. And I don't know how to say that without accusing. I think that's what I struggled with a lot. Was
like subconsciously, did you have a,
Yes. And I was trying to figure that out. What it kind of came down to in the end was she was going through her own journey with it too. And it was really complicated because we're both going through it at the same time. And so she was going through her discovery in a sense and grief, and I was going through mine. And how do you do that when both of you feel like it's happening to you instead of something that you had any control over? So that was pretty complicated. It's a lot easier to talk about now. We still don't talk about it much, and but it is easier when it does come up. And I think the hardest part is I don't know what to tell her about my relationship with my biological father, because I don't want to make it complicated with my mom. Mm-hmm. And because my dad isn't alive anymore, I don't have to struggle with the tension of what to say to my dad about it. So in some ways that's easier. But I'm also sad that I can't reassure my dad and tell him that it doesn't, there's a lot of things that doesn't change. And I still go over all the memories with my dad with as much love, and I want to hold on to them just as much as I did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I can't tell him that it's okay. So that's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that he subconsciously was afraid of that or felt like?
Yeah, I actually do. And that's really hard given the way he died, because I wonder if it weighed on him.
Mm.
And it's like this question I won't get the answer to. That's really hard.
Yeah.
And it highlights how much, I think there's still a lot that parents don't get to deal with when it comes to grieving a biological connection. It seems like there's one person in the partnership who's ready to just go full speed ahead and let's have a baby, and the other one can often be more hesitant. And I think in a partnership, sometimes that person just decides to try to ignore those feelings, and then they come up probably later. I'm glad there are resources now for parents, or more resources now for parents, to work through that either fear or grief or whatever they have. Some clinics, though, it seems it's like one meeting with a therapist and that's it. You know, yeah. Are you cleared to go ahead with this process? Yes or no. But they don't always have resources for the people who are having a hard time with using a donor. So there are more resources, I think, now, but it's still a gap that needs to be filled for parents who are working through the loss of that genetic connection or biological connection to their child.
Mm-hmm.
Or even still the shame of infertility, because it's better now, but I don't think it's.
Yes. All. Yeah, definitely. So fast forward past you finding out and your mom and you finding your father and all that stuff. So when did you get involved with everything online and start your own thing?
So because I'd been, because I cared a lot about mental health already, and I was also in the business world, I kept noticing how hard it was to find help. I was Googling to try to find people in my situation. I was looking for resources. And every time I thought, I am not the only person trying to do this. Why is it so hard to find? For example, I tried to write the letter to my biological father, and it was so hard to find, to figure out, how should I write this letter? What should I say? What should I not say? What's the etiquette for this? And I didn't even know I was donor conceived for probably, I don't even know how many years. I kept calling myself a sperm donor baby because I didn't know what else I was. And so as I was noticing these gaps, you know, I journaled a lot. And so it was kind of in the form of a question, like, why is it so hard to find help with this? And mm-hmm. I wish this resource was there. But I think I tend to be a problem solver, or I like connecting people to things. So I felt that desire to connect with people about this topic and talk with someone about it. And when it wasn't there, that's, I think, when the idea started to form of, at first it was someone should make something for people like me.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody should make something, and then I started talking, I did find We Are Donor Conceived,
mm-hmm.
the Facebook group, and that was really helpful, but I did get overwhelmed in the comment section of Facebook groups and social media pages, because I think the empathy side of me would see new people with that discovery all the time, or see what they were going through. And I wanted them to have help. Or I saw that they were going through the same thing that somebody else had just posted about the week before. And I really believed in the value of connecting with being able to share our stories. And I'd seen some really helpful things happen in peer support groups, in other parts of my life, and what can happen when you have that emotional and social support from people, and you know you're not the only one going through something. And so I really wanted to make a space where people could have smaller conversations about it, or get to know people in their community, or something besides a bigger Facebook group. And so when I was trying to figure out what it would look like, I thought I was going to be, each state there might be a group for donor conceived people, or regional. And it was just before COVID that I started thinking about what it would look like to break into smaller groups online, but I couldn't really figure out how to structure it. And then when COVID happened,
mm-hmm.
Seeing how it forced us all to just get used to getting together on Zoom, it was the perfect opportunity to build something like that. And so that's when I decided to use the peer support model, partially because it's easier to build more peer support groups than it is to have counseling in group settings, because you don't need a counselor to lead a peer support group.
Right.
And really, it's not that everybody needs counseling. They need to know they're not alone. They need to talk to someone else in the same situation and just feel like less of a freak.
Right.
to be able, it's that thing that happens where if you talk to a donor conceived person and we start talking about staring in the mirror and wondering where features come from, you can watch someone's face that you're talking to and they just light up because they get it and they've mm-hmm. done the same thing. And it's a lot more work to describe that to somebody who isn't donor conceived. They're like, what do you mean? And we all know what we mean when we say those things. So I started the first two groups in, I think I announced them in February of last year, and we started meeting in March. And at first I thought it would be like 6 to 8 weeks and it would be for people who were new to the discovery. And so I posted them with anyone who's found out in the past year or the past 2 years, and the groups filled up right away. They just didn't end after 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 10, 12. And there was so much to talk about that I realized, okay, I'm not going to be able to do this the same way I thought, where they're together for a time and then it ends. There are people who are going to want to stay. And so I added more groups. I looked a lot at the way Resolve handles support for people struggling with infertility and how valuable that's been for people struggling with infertility. And so I started to think, what if this could look like that, but for donor-conceived people? And similar to peer support groups in infertility, some people are there for 2 months or 2 weeks or 2 years, and it just depends on their journey. And I don't think there's a specific timeline for how long it takes to be okay with being donor-conceived or how long it takes to answer all the questions. It's different for every person. And so I wanted to build something where people could learn about the topics they wanted to learn about, connect with people, and feel less alone. And, you know, the word stigma just comes up again and again, because it really applies to being donor conceived. It's embarrassing to talk about sometimes because you feel like a novelty, like even yes. when people talk to their friends about it, and you talk to a friend about it and they listen, but then it kind of becomes almost like this conversation starter.
Yes. Yes. Like a weird fun fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know what you mean.
And it's like, how's that little project of yours going? And it's not intentional, I don't think, but it's hard for people to relate to it. And so, it seems like in the groups, people will talk about how friends just aren't understanding in the same way that they hoped. And it makes the groups even more important to have a place where you can talk about it. And it's not the, I win the two truths and a lie.
Uh-huh.
You know, game every time.
I have, you know, 50 siblings. Yeah.
Right. My parents have never actually met, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I think about that sometimes.
I don't know how many siblings I have. So the groups have been really helpful for that. And then as I started to see the themes of things that we talked about in multiple groups, then it gave me the idea of having topics that we talked about in workshops where people could all from all different groups could come in and talk about something together, or we could bring in an expert to talk about something like how to restore trust in broken relationships, or, you know, we started talking about specific books that everybody was interested in reading, or a documentary that everybody mm-hmm. watched. And so it's been really neat to see the community grow. And I'm really honored to make the space for people to connect. It's kind of grown as far as what I think we're going to be able to do to help people. And I'm really, really thankful because some people in the groups have gotten support there have really been able to dream up how they want to get involved and what gifts they want to use and skills they want to use. And so it's not just me making these groups. There's a lot of people either volunteering or putting in their time to help make the groups grow and offer them to more people. And we actually became a nonprofit a few weeks ago. So
hey.
Yeah. So my hope is that we can, I did start charging for the groups back in the fall because I was trying to, I was spending so much time on it that I couldn't do as much work to bring in an income. And I felt really strange about charging for the groups. It was actually people in the groups that were encouraging me to,
right,
you know, just let us pay you. This is really helpful. And it's so I did, and was just trying to figure out how to do this and spend more time on it. So once I decided that I was going to do this full time, that's when I moved forward with establishing it as a 501c3. And so now we're done with that paperwork and filing. And so now I'm just trying to update everything and put together our plan for taking donations and funding and building a budget and bringing in some more full-time or part-time people so that we can really offer more services to people. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much education and tools and resources that when I see people repeating the same emotional labor again and again, it shouldn't be that way. We should have tools for people to do these things and not have to be redoing that same work again and again. So that's what I'm really excited about, is to make the process easier for people when they do want to explore their identity, or they want to figure out how to connect with family members, or just figuring out what their path forward is, that they would have options that have some resources built in so they're not doing the work every time. I feel like everyone just spends hours and hours Googling trying to find things.
It's interesting that I just had no, like, I just did not do that. Like, what I spent Googling was like 6'2", you know, born in whatever, like, you know, to find the guy. And then once I did, I was like, okay, anyway, close my computer, never thought about it. Like how you're talking about, you're agonizing over what to put in this letter. I'm like, I'm glad I was 15 and I handwrote this thing that was like, hey, remember me? Maybe not, you know, like, and just like mailed it away, you know.
I think it depends on the life stage, right? When I wrote him, I was thinking more about my kids wouldn't be who they are today if this man wasn't my biological father. Like, mm-hmm. I'd already seen the layers of, well, I'm who I am, but also my kids are who they are because of this stranger. So, yeah. But of course at 15, I would have looked right at it completely different. I do think it's funny though, you know, as I say, looking for a resource to write a letter. Someone pointed this out in the group and I thought it was just great, that the way that you decide to reach out to your biological relative, that might just instinctively be similar to how they want to be reached out to, because you are related. So that impulsive sort of, let me just write a letter. Like, what if you got that from him? And so what if he's an impulsive, hey, I got a letter, you know?
Yeah.
And so
he emailed me back the day after, you know, like this, like,
right.
Yeah.
Like, not deliberate. And here, the fact that I spent months agonizing over the letter, and I actually had someone follow up with me twice and say, did you send it yet? And I said, I'm afraid to send it. And so when I go meet him, what does it turn out to be?
That he doesn't know what to say. Yeah. That's funny.
That's who I might've gotten that from. So I don't want to act like there's some perfect way to do it, because there's not. And I love the idea that part of maybe the way to go forward is in your DNA, literally, to map it out. The other reason I think it's important to not focus on there being a perfect way is because then it puts the blame on the person if it doesn't work out. And there are so many people who either don't get a response or get a cease and desist letter, or get told like, this was supposed to be anonymous, don't ever talk to me again, or here's the medical information, but please never let my family know that you exist. That's not because they did it wrong. And I wouldn't want to say, oh, if you would have done this a different way, you would have gotten a different result, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's not, it's not about that.
But yeah, it's interesting. So when you wrote this letter at 15, you got an email the next day.
Well, kind of. My parents were definitely more like, you know, thinking about all of this. And they definitely were doing the whole like putting his feelings and situations kind of at the forefront of being like, well, what about it? What if he's remarried or something, or, you know, all of that, like not wanting to intrude, and which makes sense. Like, it is fair to be concerned about that. So they like made me wait probably like a month or something. And then my mom set it up where it was, I don't know what that's called, like certified mail, where he like had to go to the post office and sign for it so that they knew that he had gotten mm-hmm. the letter at least. Cause that's like not a type of thing that you don't want to, you want right. to know whether or not right. they at least saw it. So when I talked to him, I think it is the second episode when I did my, when I had a conversation with him, he was saying how he remembers thinking, like, who sued me? Like, why do I have to go sign for this thing at the post office? And it's just like this handwritten, like, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, then I think that day or the day after, he sent an email to me and my sister. Which
he was just relieved that he wasn't being sued.
That it was just
his biological daughter. it's funny. I put my letter in a shoebox greeting card envelope with a card because I didn't want it to look legal and then get him scared. So it's funny, just trying to even, you're trying to get in the mind of a stranger of what's going to be okay for them. And, but also you don't want to be sitting with this doubt of, did they get it? So I had that doubt of wondering, but you did not, because your mom, you know,
made sure. That's a pretty good idea. Recommend.
Yeah. I think in the groups, people, it's one of the things that people share a lot in the groups, of just asking like, what should I do? How should I write this letter? And they can then hear from multiple different people and kind of pick from people's stories of, this is how I did it, this is what I wish I would have done differently. And then people kind of get a chance to build their own plan of how they want to do it based on just hearing stories from different people of which way it can go, which is nice, because again, it's not like here's the one right way to do it. But how else would you hear those stories? How else would you hear, how did you reach out to your biological father that mm-hmm. your parents have never met, that you have no information on other than their name and
right.
email address or what city and state they live in? And maybe if you did some Facebook research, you know, like their occupation. Right. And what they look like. And so
right, I had never met another donor conceived person until all of the Facebook groups and the peer support, like all of that, besides my own family.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I am in the like younger group where it's becoming more and more common, like I still had never, well, maybe met in like maybe a kid of a family friend who I haven't seen since I was 5, like very few, like nobody that I would ever be able to have a conversation with about all of it.
Did you talk about it at school?
I don't know if I talked about the idea of having a sperm donor as a, like in elementary school. Like I was definitely open about like, I have two moms. I remember my brother got in trouble at school, or like they got a phone call because they were doing like a family tree thing, or they were doing like a talking about your family. And he was like, I have two sisters, because this was after we had met my sister Isabel. So he would have been like 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And the teacher was like, we know Kaylee, like there isn't like, who is he talking about, you know? And they had to like explain this whole thing, which is kind mm-hmm. of funny. But yeah, no, I mean, I had one negative situation happen when I was in seventh grade science class, when this kid who like, you know, had like religious parents was like, he called me like a test tube baby, or was like, it's, you know, made all these weird kind of comments. I remember it upset me, and I talked to my favorite teacher about it. And but yeah, no, I think it was like a common thing, like, we don't know who Kaylee's dad is. You know, that was like a running sort of joke, almost like.
I've heard lots of parents, when I'm in this, especially in social media spaces, they say, well, we don't need to talk about our child having a donor because it's going to be obvious because we have same-sex parents, so it'll be obvious. And then it's always seemed like a risk, because I think about now as a mom of three kids, or even thinking back to my own childhood of what maybe should have been obvious to me but was not obvious to me. And I have heterosexual parents, but I remember talking to my mom about how babies were made and thinking to myself, I remember saying out loud to her, I thought to myself, I thought, oh, you know, what a weird thing for two adults to do. But I said out loud to her, at least you only had to do that one time and you got two babies. Because I had twins. So that to me, like, there's a whole lot that even when it's explained, you don't really understand. And kids believe in tooth fairies and Santa Claus and,
right, that's
and
true.
Leprechauns. And something. Is it really that obvious?
Yeah, now that I think about it, I don't know if it was really something that was spoken about like often until this whole situation came up when I was probably about seven. So that's like, I don't have a lot of really early memories, but it's true that I don't know when it would have dawned on me had that not happened. Like, I don't know if they had told me or they had, because it is true. Like, you would think it would be obvious, like maybe by the time that they're 10, it's obvious. But what about before that? That's,
yeah, I truly don't know the answer of that. That's, I'm so curious about when a kid would figure out that because they have two moms that
something is up. Like
that, I mean, I get the social piece of them looking around and saying, okay, some families have two moms, some have two dads, some have one parent, some have a mom and a dad. But the part of looking at their own family and saying, for me to get here, it took an egg and a sperm, and neither one of the two people in my family would have a sperm if I had two moms. I don't know that that part is as obvious as parents say, like, because it's socially obvious among their friends. If you have, you know,
right, then something would have happened. Yeah.
Right. But I don't think for kids, I don't know when the ages that that would be.
Yeah,
that
I don't know.
Dawn on them. Oh yeah, somebody, that sperm had to come from somewhere.
I mean, I definitely remember the conversations of some families have two moms and some have a mom and a dad, but I didn't know anybody else just because I grew up in like this sort of WASPy area of Connecticut, you know, like that was just not the vibe, I guess. So it was, I remember asking my mom, like, well, why? Like, why are you both women? Like, I remember, I've definitely said some like homophobic type, like, you know, I was like six, like being like, I don't get it. Like, why are you both women? Like, why, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't really remember how that would have been handled. I don't know what I would do if my kid said that to me.
Like, and it does show the importance of being able to look around and see people.
Representation
of families, and otherwise you do feel like the exception. Even if you're confident that they love you, they're, you know, that it's still wondering, why are we different than other people? Or other families. But I don't know how that works, where families are open and communicating about the structure of their family, the roles of the people, like we have two dads or two moms. But when would it happen that a child, if they weren't specifically told, when would it be obvious to them that a sperm came or an egg came from somebody, or even a uterus if it's two dads? Like, oh, somebody had to carry me in their tummy for me to be here. But I guess it probably wasn't as much of a topic if you grew up in a setting where you were kind of the exception, your family structure was the exception. You weren't talking with other people who were comparing notes on how they were.
Right. Conceived. I don't know, because I was like, I wonder if I was just under the assumption that I was adopted, because that could have. But then I feel like, no, I don't think I thought that. It's weird. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask my parents, like, what. Yeah, I'll ask them about
that. Well, at least it doesn't sound traumatic. It's not like you have a thought
It of. I thought of it was a really cool thing, because it was like, we're going to meet this girl, you know, like this person. And, you know, and it was so bizarre because it was like, she's like a month older than me and we look super similar. And I was like, whoa, you know, new friend. And it was like a fun thing when we would go have play dates with Isabel in New York. You know, it was like a thing we looked forward to.
And it seems like there probably have to be a question there somewhere of how are we sisters or how are we half sisters, if that was explained to you.
Yes. And
You would
it,
have to have that, but it probably just didn't land because you're eight and your brain can only hold so much
right. But over time, it definitely did. Like, over time, that became like a thing we would bond about. Or, like, I remember we had like a book that we like this doodle type of thing where it was like, I don't know if we definitely didn't say our dad, like our donor or something. And like almost fantasizing about these different things about like us being sisters. And we're like, we're gonna write about, you know, like that was a thing that we bonded about, I think.
And if you don't remember some really scary conversation, that's a great thing. That means you did slowly learn it over time. I can't remember if you already talked about this. How many siblings do you have now? 11
11 other people,
Okay.
one of them being his raised son,
Okay.
and one of them being like 7 years younger than the rest of the group because of a weird mix up with the catalogs.
Weird mix-ups, that's kind of a thing. Did your the way you talk about the language that you use about being donor conceived, how did that change from, because you were mentioning you were talking to your sister about and it was your donor, and now you mentioned your father. When did you notice that changing?
I think I started to reconsider around the time when I found him and started like emailing with him for a while before we met. Because I do think I have a memory of my parents saying something like, you don't have a father, like you have a donor. Like that was the sort of, and I think that was probably, I think I can remember it more being my not biological mom saying that. And she's like, a father like means something. Like a father is the person that like raised you. And she was really close with her dad who passed away, you know. So I think that it had something to do with like feeling that sort of insecurity, like why you don't have a father, you know, you don't have a dad. It's like this donor, like this person, you know. And I think I kind of just accepted that. But then over time, and I think probably it does have to do with hearing from all these other people and like all this discourse about language and, you know, relationships and stuff. It's like he is my father, my biological father, because everybody does have both of those things, you know. So it's not like I'm not like dethroning my mother or something by saying, you know, father, biological father.
Well, the way that I've tried to describe it is that there's the relationship and then there's the role and the relationship and then there's the genetic piece that so it's not a threat. I mean, I understand why parents feel threatened and I understand the temptation to say, well, you don't have a mother or you don't have a father. It's just, I think it doesn't respect that people, kids even, but especially people can have room for both to say, these are my parents. They raised me. They love me. This is my family. And then also, I have a biological father or I have a biological mother. And that's genetically how I was made, biologically how I was made. And even if I decide to pursue an actual relationship with them, it doesn't have to threaten the two people who gave me this, you know, gave me my family and love me unconditionally and fill in the actual parenting role. And I've seen it said parenting is a noun and a verb. And so there's the parent verb, which you have two of, and then there's parent noun, which you have more of than, you know.
That's true. Yeah, like when I say my parents, I'm like talking about my mom's most of the time, like in conversation.
Yeah, I hope it is something you can use. I don't
Yeah,
know.
I'll be able to.
It's all very like calm and mellow, so I don't know. It might be like a someone's evening listening before they fall asleep.
But yeah, no.
That's actually something really funny that I had people tell me so many different times in life, like, Melissa, your voice is really like calming.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually once when you were talking.
So it's so strange because when I heard someone talking about him who knew him, they said, he's got the calmest voice.
Oh,
so soothing. He's got this great bedside manner. And I thought, that is so, like, for someone to be told their voice is soothing and calm, and for me to hear that, it's like, that's really weird to hear that same thing, because we're both, I mean, it's not that I'm like a shy, calm, quiet, introverted, calm person, you know? So to hear that your voice is soothing, and then to hear that about him, like, his voice is soothing. That was one of those moments where I was like, okay, that's an interesting similarity to be told. So, but probably not great for a podcast because it's very like, la, la, la.
No.
Me again. We spoke for a little while longer, but I think this is a good place to end it.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Have good a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, thanks to Melissa for sharing her story. And thank you for listening. I will see you next Thursday. Bye.